From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Wednesday, August the 5th, 2020, and we have a good full show lined up for you today. We're going to get an update first off on progress or lack thereof or whatever's happening actually on the cannabis legislation that's been working its way through the Vermont legislature, it seems like, for decades now. Last real action, I think the House passed a bill back in February to bring about retail sales and taxation regulation of cannabis in Vermont, as many other states which have legalized marijuana have done. And but then, of course, the pandemic hit and everything kind of got frozen. We're thinking about the possibility of, our legislators are thinking about the possibility of unthawing some of these things back in the winter when things were frozen. We are now fast forward through this pandemic. They're coming back at the late August, mainly to deal with budget stuff, but some other legislation may pop out as well, and that could include cannabis reform legislation in Vermont. We're going to be talking with Matt Simon of the Marijuana Policy Project about that in just a minute, just after I tell you about what else is coming up on the program this morning. In the second half hour, reporter Kevin McCollum of 7 Days has an interesting story about how town clerks, city clerks, municipal clerks, I guess we'll call them, here in Vermont are getting ready to deal with all the changes in elections this year, with a huge emphasis on mail-in ballots. Vermonters are being urged to fill out their mail-in ballots and mail them in, and that creates a new set of challenges for our municipal clerks. We're going to be talking with Carol Dawes of the City of Barrie. She's the city clerk in Barrie, and we're going to also be talking with Kevin McCollum, as I mentioned, talking about the challenges faced by these municipal clerks as they face next week's primary here in Vermont, and then, of course, the upcoming November election, which is expected to draw a really big turnout, given it's the presidential election year and an election with a lot of interest, shall we say, around it. In the latter hour of today's show, we're going to be talking about, there's a hearing tonight. It's going to be a virtual hearing, as they have been lately, with everybody online, but it involves the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and they are drafting, in the final stages, it seems, of drafting or holding public hearings to draft their 10-year plan for managing big game in Vermont, the big game species in Vermont. Those are include bears and deer and moose and turkeys. I did not know turkey was a big game species, but until yesterday. But there you go. So they're drafting this plan. They want the public's participation. We're going to have a couple of people on from the Department of Fish and Wildlife in the second hour of the program to talk about what the plans say and why folks might want to tune in tonight and get involved. So, but let's start right in with Matt Simon. I believe he is on the phone with us. And good morning, Matt. Thank you very much for joining me.
Yes. Good morning, Dave. Thanks for having me.
So, update us now. Where are we on this cannabis reform legislation in Vermont? Do I have it roughly right? The House passed a bill. Yeah. The Senate had previously passed a bill. House passed a bill in February. Now what?
Yeah, that's right. It's hard to think about it being frozen, given how hot it's been the last few weeks. But essentially, that metaphor is correct. S-54 passed the Senate in a 23-5 vote last year, and then it passed the House in a different form in February in a 90-54 vote. And shortly after that, as you said, the pandemic hit. A committee of conference was formed. It was one of the last things the legislature did before it went on pause and everybody became really focused on the short-term, you know, COVID response type of thing. But this is a bill that's essentially, if I can go to a football metaphor, it's on the one-yard line. It's passed both chambers by big margins. And the last step is for a committee of conference to come up with a final version that would go forward to the governor's desk. And, you know, the comments from leadership all along have been that will happen in August. So we anticipate that work will likely begin within the next few weeks. And we're just trying to revive that discussion. I think a few things have changed. I mean, Vermonters overwhelmingly supported this before COVID, but the reasons have only grown stronger. And as much as we focused on public health and public safety and teen use and consumer protection and all the other issues. In light of what Vermont's facing economically, we think that it makes a lot of sense to look at the economic benefits that are associated with this bill. And to that end, a law firm based in Denver, Colorado, called Vicente Cederberg LLP, has done a detailed economic analysis, which is being published today, and it projects substantially more revenue than was originally expected in the Joint Fiscal Office's estimate.
There was I remember the famous RAND study. Which estimated how much did the RAND study estimate Vermont would reap in tax revenue every year? I think there was a number kicking around for a while.
Yeah, there were a lot of numbers in the RAND report. It was a very detailed document, but it was published in 2016. And frankly, that's 4 years in the world of cannabis is like probably 10 or 20 years in other financial sectors in terms of how much we've learned about the markets, about what the economists call regulatory market capture. You know, for years, legislators have talked about wanting to eliminate the illicit market and transition sales into a regulated marketplace. And they've also talked about wanting to go slow. And it turns out that those two concepts are kind of at odds. And some states have recognized that. Nevada is one example where they passed their initiative and it was kind of a go slow approach. And the governor stepped in and said, no, we need to move much more quickly. And they decided to move towards an early sales model. So that's something that's been part of the discussion all along around S-54. A lot of people have suggested it's kind of a go-slow approach that wouldn't bring in money for a few years, and that if licensing could begin more quickly. So that's been part of the discussion all along. This report goes more into detail about what kind of money is on the table if Vermont wanted to go that direction, again, licensing cultivators and begin early start sales in 2021 rather than 2 years down the road. And to be clear, and the vast majority of advocates for cannabis regulation will support any reasonable version of this bill that comes out of the conference committee. We just think in light of COVID that it makes sense to revisit that discussion about how quick to get moving and how much money are we really talking about here.
So how much money does this new study indicate Vermont could reap in tax revenues from a retail cannabis market?
So the big picture, if early sales begin in 2021, the report anticipates it could be over $175 million in cannabis taxes through the year 2025. Even if early sales don't begin early, even if they just stick with the bills, the estimates from JFO are likely quite low from two reasons. JFO projected $13.8 million in tax revenue for fiscal year 2024 and $17.4 million in 2025. And we always kind of thought those were lowball estimates, but we were not fixated on the money question. We've always said it's a good idea whether it brings in $10 million or $40 million. It's a good idea for all of the other reasons. But looking and after this economist really dug through, it looks like JFO was using data from a few years ago on estimates of per consumer consumption. And they were very much lowballing it, but the market data from Washington and Colorado and other states suggests that consumers who have used cannabis in the past month use about twice as much or even more than that of what JFO's estimates were based on. So that's one reason the likely revenues would be higher than what they projected. And another reason is it doesn't look like they factored in border consumers in their estimates. And as you know, and most people know, New York has been talking about legalizing cannabis for quite a while, but they haven't done it and are very unlikely to do it this year. And New Hampshire is even arguably farther behind on on the issue. So there's no telling when New Hampshire might get to a regulated market. And so Vermont, if it could begin, particularly if it could begin early, there would be a lot of money potentially on the table from border consumers that certainly not going to fill the $570 million shortfall or whatever it is that's being projected associated with COVID. But we're talking about thousands of jobs. We're talking about tens of millions of dollars in revenue that, frankly, how can that be left on the table when 76% of Vermonters already support having regulated and taxed businesses in Vermont and think we should already be there? So sense of urgency, I think, is really warranted here.
What are the key differences between the House and Senate versions of these of the bill right now?
There are a number of small and subtle differences. Probably the biggest one is the tax rate. One version includes a 2% local option tax, and the other version does not. I'm going to forget which version is which offhand. I don't have it in front of me, but they're very mm-hmm. close to the same, and the report goes into the slight differences between the two. And they're I'm going to forget some of the details, but the House did a lot of work on this bill. They hadn't spent a lot of time on the issue prior to S-54 relative to the Senate, and they did a lot of work, and they tweaked a bunch of things that, that's normally what a conference committee does, is go through each of the changes and talks them through. But
do you sense that, or is your understanding that the conference committee is close? Do you think they're going to have an agreement in the short window of legislative activity we're going to see upcoming?
Well, I'm confident they'll be able to reach agreement. I don't believe they've met yet. They may have. I hope they've been studying this issue on their own, but I don't believe they've had a formal meeting yet. But we're mm-hmm. hopeful that will happen quite soon. And as you know, the legislature plans to reconvene in late August. And so hopefully by then, this is one of the issues. You know, we think it made total sense to focus on the short-term COVID response type of thing, but this is an economic recovery bill, and we think it's really one of the pieces of legislation that should be essential to how Vermont's thinking about economic recovery post-COVID or in the wake of COVID.
Do you think the financial hit the state has taken from COVID actually kind of helps your cause? Is it a little bit of an extra push for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's, again, this was already overwhelmingly supported and overwhelmingly supported inside the House and Senate, but absolutely the money that is on the table, I don't think Vermont can afford to leave that money on the table, can't afford to let this bill die on the 1 yard line when there are thousands of jobs and tens of millions of dollars in tax revenue at stake. And the flip side of that is looking at potentially having to cut services and make difficult budget decisions that nobody wants to face. So every $1 million you would think would be very important in that equation, and hopefully that would lead to even more consensus in the legislature and even more of a sense of urgency.
And the what are you hearing from the executive branch? Is the governor gonna sign the bill, veto it? What's he gonna do?
Well, the governor's been understandably focused on the COVID response type of thing, so I don't think anybody's mm-hmm. really asked him about this in the last few months. But you know, it's first things first. Let's get a good bill from the committee of conference. Let's have the House and Senate approve it. Let's build consensus around that, both in the building, or I don't know if anybody's in the building, but metaphorically in the building and you know, statewide, that this is the right thing to do and that it's important. And, you know, we certainly hope the governor will see the wisdom in signing the bill.
I had the impression early in the session, you know, back in January and February, before the whole COVID crisis hit, that there was some new energy or new people popping up and organizing in opposition to the idea of marijuana sales, retail sales. I remember talking to a couple of folks who said they were not going to try to push for, you know, any kind of a repeal of the law passed a couple of years ago allowing possession of small amounts of cannabis, but they didn't want to take any further steps in this direction. And is it your sense that was the case, that there was sort of some new people, new energy involved in the opposition early in the session, and or, you know, maybe as stretching back into last fall, and are they still active? What's happening on that front?
No, I would say that what happened early this session were a few of the same people that have been fighting against this, in some cases for more than a decade, and people who were against decrim and medical cannabis before we were even to this point. You know, they brought in a few people from out of state, and they sent out a press release and did some media interviews. You know, there was even a state police chaplain from New Jersey came up to Vermont to speak against the perils of regulated cannabis, which they don't have in New Jersey, and they should, but that's another question. Mm-hmm. Most people have figured out, and you know, that was the biggest fear with Colorado, are we doing something that could cause teen use to go up and hurt public health? And the reality is just the opposite. That consumers are overwhelmingly choosing to buy cannabis from the regulated market. They sold over $1 billion through the regulated system. In the last several years, they've raised hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes, and teen use is actually down in Colorado, and public health and public safety are much better protected by the regulatory system than they ever were by having all of that commerce be conducted by unlicensed actors. So for the same reasons that alcohol prohibition failed, cannabis prohibition was a failure. Regulation is a much better approach. People in states with regulated cannabis markets are very happy with those. And Vermont has, I believe, the highest teen use rate still in the entire nation, or at least in the top three. And the most rational way to address that would be to begin regulating sales to adults, require an ID at the point of sale. That seems like the most obvious thing in the world to a lot of people, and it's proving to work in other states, and yet some people in Vermont seem to think that an unlicensed, unregulated market is better, and those are the kinds of markets that really flourish in high schools and colleges and really prey on younger consumers who, you know, they might be able to get cannabis when it's legal, but it will be more difficult for them than it is probably under current circumstances.
We are talking about the legislation that would move Vermont past its where it is now, which is it legalized small amounts of cannabis possession a couple of years ago. You can grow a couple yourself, but there was no provision in that law for actual sales of marijuana in Vermont, and so we've had this strange situation where possession is okay, sales still technically prohibited. Is that right, Matt?
Yeah, that's right. It is a strange situation. It feels very much like the late 1920s or 1931, when alcohol possession was essentially decriminalized. It wasn't a problem to have a little bit in your house, but there were no regulated sales, and this created an absolute public health and public safety nightmare. I think we have an analogous situation with cannabis, and if we really care about public health and public safety, we need a sense of urgency about moving forward with the regulated market.
Yeah, now I don't know if I don't know if some of the old movies or even that terrific series that was on cable a few years ago called Boardwalk Empire may have sensationalized prohibition, alcohol prohibition a little bit, but things aren't quite as wild and woolly as they were in Atlantic City back there in the late 20s, from what I can gather.
What's analogous, Dave, is from a consumer's perspective. In a regulated market, you walk into a liquor store, you buy a bottle of something that's 80 proof, it's not going to kill you. It doesn't have industrial alcohol in it. It doesn't have impurities. It wasn't made in somebody's bathtub. And you walk into a regulated cannabis store, if you want to do that, there are, I believe, 7 of them within 15 miles of Vermont's southern border at this point in Massachusetts. You walk in, and there are regulated products that have been tested by independent labs that are labeled with potency, that have different cannabinoids, the amounts labeled on them. You know that it doesn't have mold on it. You know it doesn't have heavy metals. You know it doesn't have pesticides. And you can't buy it unless you're 21. And while cannabis prohibition may not seem as dramatic of a failure of alcohol prohibition, I would argue that it's often because we don't see what's actually happening when bad things happen in the market, and how we tend to blame cannabis or blame drugs generally for anything that goes wrong. And we just don't have the imagination to see how this could be better managed in a regulated system. One example last year when the vape cartridges were leading to all of these unexplained deaths. And what we know now is that in the regulated system, that this wasn't happening, that these were adulterants that were introduced to cut illicit market vape oils to make it go further. And a lot of people have forgotten about that because a lot's happened since last year. But this was a failure of the unregulated, unlicensed market, and people were dying from it who did not need to die. Nobody needs to die from consuming cannabis, and it's crazy that we can't get to a point where people can buy products as they do with alcohol that have known purity and known potency.
How does that actually work? I mean, I haven't actually gone shopping down in for cannabis down in Greenfield and Northampton, or wherever, you know, down the I-91 corridor. And I'm just wondering, if I were to walk into a cannabis shop down there to buy some, what would I actually, I mean, I sort of know when I walk into a state liquor store in Vermont that I can look at different, you know, alcoholic beverages, spirits, basically, and know whether they are 80 proof or 100 proof. You can look at a can of beer and it'll tell you with the alcohol by volume content. What does the label actually say? What are the units that are measured in if you're going to buy, some cannabis?
Yeah, it's all right there on the label. Not only on the label, it's on the website. And I would add that during COVID, you can't walk into the cannabis stores in Massachusetts the way you could a few months ago. You have to place orders in advance and either pick them up curbside, or each store has come up with its own process. But prior to COVID and still today, if you just call them and talk to them, there are people who work at the stores who could answer questions about how things are labeled and what things mean. But obviously, THC, the amount of THC is the big one that most people look for first. We're seeing more labels now that are total active cannabinoids are listed on the label, and it goes through all the cannabinoids that have been isolated. A lot of people who are using cannabis for medical reasons, or, you know, have a particular effect that they're looking for, whether that be pain relief or sleep, they'll learn that there are certain cannabinoids or certain terpenes, and the terpenes are the scent molecules that are associated with cannabis and other plants, but there's a lot of research that suggests they have an impact on the effect. So people who are using cannabis to treat insomnia and to relax and unwind at the end of a long day will learn that they want certain cannabinoid profiles and certain terpene profiles to give them what they want. And somebody who wants to clean the house all day on a Saturday and have a bunch of energy will seek a different product.
Smoke something else. Matt Simon, we're about out of time, but I appreciate you spending some time with us this morning and updating us on the situation here. Thank you very much for joining us, Matt Simon, at the Marijuana Policy Project. We're going to go ahead to a bottom of the hour CBS News break and back with more of the Dave Graham Show upcoming, folks. Stay with us.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Dilly takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
There is a primary election coming up next Tuesday, August the 11th, and a lot of people are voting already. I actually just heard an ad in the first half hour of our program for Pat Winburn, one of the Democrats seeking the gubernatorial nomination, and it occurred to me that if I decided, based on that ad, and that's what they're for, they're trying to convince people to vote for somebody. If I decided, boy, that guy sounds like he's really got something on the ball, I want to vote for him. Too late, because I already mailed in my mail-in ballot. So one of these days, I think I'm going to get a couple of political scientists with expertise in campaign advertising on the show to talk about how you rearrange that your strategy around campaign advertising in the age of the mail-in ballot. What does that mean? You're going to be hitting a lot of ears out there of people who've already voted. And it seems to be a growing thing. We no longer have election day. We seem to have election season these days. And one of the other aspects of the thing is that the municipal clerks around Vermont are having to make adjustments in their normal election day routines or election season routines with the influx of mail-in ballots coming in. And Kevin McCallum, who's a terrific reporter for 7 days, did a story for today's newspaper. It's good to out. He'll be hitting the streets a little bit later today. And we got a sneak advance peek here at WDEV. And Kevin joins us this morning. Tell us a little bit about his story. We're going to be talking with him. And we are also going to be talking with Carol Dawes, who is the municipal clerk in Barrie. And Ms. Dawes is somebody who's been around elections for a while in the city of Barrie and might have some interesting things to tell us about the changes she is seeing and how they are going to be operating. I think we have both on the phone this morning, Kevin McCallum and Carol Dawes, and I thank the two of you very much for joining me.
Glad to be here.
Good to be here, Dave. let's start with you, Kevin, and just ask your sort of big picture story here. You talked to some municipal clerks, and what are you hearing in general?
Well, including Carol, she's in my story that comes out this morning. So yeah, no, we wanted to see whether there was going to be a problem with town clerks in Vermont, given that there were so many people who had requested absentee ballots and were beginning to send them back. And so we wondered how they were going to manage through that crush of absentee ballots, given that we've heard so much about how it might be difficult to get poll workers this year. And sure enough, it really has been a surge in absentee ballot requests and a flood, really, of absentee ballots returning to town clerks all over the state. And they've been struggling, but apparently managing fairly well to keep up with the high volume of people who've already voted.
And Carol Dawes, the city clerk in Barrie. First, let me ask, how long have you been city clerk? I know you're a veteran in this position, and so you've been around elections for a while in Vermont.
Yeah, I started in 08, so a little over 12 years. So I started with a presidential year, and so this will be my, I don't know, fifth one or something like that. So
wow. And you're getting a bit of a, I don't know, a dry run or a dress rehearsal or something in the midsummer primary upcoming for the, you know, there's a lot of interest in some legislative races. It seems like the main focus, certainly for those of us in the media, in the statewide races. What is that feeling like so far?
Well, it's in some parts it's same old, same old. You know, we're accepting absentee ballot requests from people. The big changes, of course, are volume. we're coming right up on 1,600 absentee ballot requests for this primary. Last year, which of course was a midterm primary, not a presidential year, we had a little over 200. So you can see that the volume is considerably larger. As a matter of fact, we're looking at more people participating in this primary than ever during my tenure, including absentees and in person. So that's been a challenge dealing with the volume, but it basically is just ramping up the processes we already have in place. Probably the other big challenge besides dealing with volume is that my staff has all been out on partial furlough since the middle of March. And so we've been trying to do it with less people. Thankfully, everybody's back full time this week. So, you know, the final push this week and next week, I'm fully staffed. So that's helpful.
Right. And tell me about, you said you have roughly 1,600. These are, I mean, there's a multi-step process here. People got postcards in the mail saying, hey, send this postcard in and we'll send you an absentee ballot. That's step one. So that's the request. When you send that postcard in, that is the request for the absentee ballot, correct?
Yeah, and certainly the majority of the ones that we have came through that process. But we started with over 300 requests before the postcards even went out, because when people requested their town meeting ballots back in January, February, they requested ballots for the whole year. So we already had a chunk to start with.
Okay. And so you now must be seeing the second stage of the process, which is when somebody sends that postcard in and you mail them their absentee ballot, they then sit and fill it out and decide, you know, are they going to take the, you know, the Republican or the Progressive, the Democrat ballot, and then further decide which of the candidates running in these three primaries, you know, the one they select, I should say, which of the candidates do they like and want to vote for. So they fill out their ballot and then they mail that back in. And how many of those have you received, the actual ballots?
Right around 900.
I see. Okay. So, and is that volume picking up a lot this week? I mean, we only have a few days to go basically before the August 11th deadline, basically.
Yeah, we'll see. You know, we'll see. We're not going to see 100% return. We never do. But we will certainly get, you know, probably another 500 or so over the next week. You know, less than a week, because they have to be returned by close of polls on Tuesday. So So now we're into the next phase of processing.
Right. And Kevin McCollum of 7 Days, what are clerks telling you out there? It sounds like they're rising to the occasion, basically. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, absolutely. And I thank Carol for walking me through that process in preparation for this story. It's a fascinating process. And yes, clerks around the state are really working hard to stay ahead of this this flood of absentee ballots. I did find that they are coming up with some creative ways to do so. Many of them are worried about being overwhelmed by having to count all of these ballots either by hand or by the tabulator machines on the day of the election, which is normally what would happen, right? But because of the pandemic and because of the recognition that there was going to be this influx of absentee ballots, Secretary Jim Condos changed some of the rules about how clerks could work this year, as I understand it. And one of the things that he allowed was for clerks to begin tabulating ballots ahead of time. So normally you wouldn't see that tabulator machine being used in the clerk's office until election day at the polling site. But this year, some town clerks around the state have started to process and tabulate those ballots ahead of time because they were worried about getting behind. So I went up to Cambridge and we talked to the town clerk there, and we watched them count with these tabulator machines many of the absentee ballots that they're getting in, which I found interesting. I'd never seen ballots being counted before election day, but they were trying to stay ahead of things, and so they actually set up a live video feed of them counting absentee ballots because they need to do that in a transparent way. And so they had a live video feed going of them counting the ballots, and the clerk up there, Mark Schilling, did that on Friday with a couple poll workers, and it was a very interesting process to watch.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, does that actually enable people to know election outcomes early, possibly?
Yeah. So that was the first question we had. We said, wait, early voting? You're counting these things ahead of time? What's going on? Absolutely not. No, the way that it works is they're feeding the ballots into the tabulator machine. And Carol, correct me if I have this wrong. The tabulator machine counts the ballot, scans the ballot, registers who voted for whom, but it doesn't reveal that information until a separate program is run at the very end of the process after Election Day is completed. Then they can run and find out how people voted. But up until then, all that the tabulator is doing is marking and letting the clerk know how many of these ballots it has processed, it has tabulated up until that point.
That's correct. And one thing I would say is that the current law actually does allow clerks to process ballots the day before an election to begin this process of feeding them into the tabulator. What Secretary Kondos did was essentially just extend that to the 30 days before the election instead of limiting it just to the one day.
I see. Okay. So... And Carol Dawes, you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that you had 1,600 roughly requests for ballots, for mail-in ballots in Barrie. You don't expect 100% of those requests to be followed up with people actually sending in the mail-in ballots that you send to them. If you send somebody a mail-in ballot, you know, the Smith family or, you know, John Smith on Maple Avenue gets a mail-in ballot and then ends up showing up on Election Day at City Hall and said, I decided to vote in the old-fashioned way. Mr. Smith can still do that, correct?
Yep. What we do is, because I have my computer there, we have access to the statewide voter checklist where we track absentee ballots. We'll be able to confirm. We have not received a ballot back yet from Mr. Smith. And there will be a form that he'll sign that says either I've chosen not to vote this ballot or I never got it or I lost it or whatever. And then he'll be able to vote.
Okay. So, I mean, I think people ought to understand that remains an option. It's obviously, let me ask you, Carol Dawes, as a clerk in the city of Barrie, during this COVID crisis, this pandemic, would you kind of, for lack of a better way of putting it, would you kind of rather not see folks on Election Day?
Yeah, like you said, you hate to put it that way. I mean, I want to make sure that everybody has the opportunity to vote in whatever manner works best for them. But if we can reduce the number of in-person voting, the number of people who come to the polls, then that's better for everybody's safety, for poll workers, for voters, everybody.
Mm-hmm. And give me a percentage. What are you in terms of next Tuesday's primary? What are you seeing? Do you think that this is this whole sort of new system and new emphasis on mail-in voting is working to a 30% degree, a 60% degree, an 80% degree? What are you expecting and seeing so far?
Boy, I have no idea. I've had conversations with people about this. I could have 50 people in person during the day. I could have 500. I really have no idea. My guess is it's going to be closer to the lower number than the higher number, particularly looking at what we've had in the past. We've never had much over 1,300 people total, and here we are with 1,600 absentee requests so far. So it doesn't give me any idea as to what sort of scale we're looking at. We're preparing for 500, and I'm telling my poll workers to bring their knitting in case we're sitting around twiddling our thumbs.
And bring their masks.
Yeah.
So,
we'll have plenty of. We've got all the PPE for them. The state has provided us with masks and gloves and face shields and wipes, sanitizing, hand sanitizer, all kinds of stuff.
Wow. And when you mentioned the 1,300 that typically show up, you're referring there, just to clarify, you're referring there to a primary, a state primary election in a presidential year?
Yes.
Or,
yep.
Okay. And people, you know, need to keep this in mind as well when they think about the numbers of people who are requesting ballots or the numbers of people who are actually turning up or sending ballots in or whatever. Anytime you're looking at these numbers, you want to compare with an analogous prior election to see whether there really are any big changes in participation. And because obviously the November election will draw a much bigger turnout than an August primary in Vermont, right?
Correct. And you really do have to sort of look at, was it a presidential year or not? Was there an open governor's race? You know, was there no incumbent, so it was a completely open governor's race, or other races that people are really taking an interest in? That can make a huge difference in the turnout for the August primary.
Right, and also just to put the 1,600 in perspective, which, you know, again, the first number you gave us was the number of people who had requested absentee ballots in the city of Barrie. How many registered voters live in Barrie?
About 5,500.
Okay, so you know that's almost a third of the registered voters so far have then requested absentee ballots. With the big push on with the Secretary of State really advertising this and coming on the Dave Graham Show and other media, et cetera, were you hoping for a higher percentage?
It's always nice. We'd love to have a much stronger voter participation, but to be perfectly frank, the August primaries tend to be our lowest participation elections. It's not something that, you know, it's in August. It's a period of time when people are away on vacation. It's, you know, a lot of people don't understand what it is, and they just don't have the level of interest that they do for town meeting or the presidential election.
Kevin McCallum, what are you hearing from other clerks out there just in terms of interest in this year's August primary? I mean, it strikes me that for a statewide primary, there actually has been a fair amount of, ferment online and stuff just talking about, all the candidates running for lieutenant governor, for instance, some really interesting races on, you know, for both the Republicans and Democrats there. And of course, the gubernatorial race, definitely has its fans. Are you sensing from clerks out there that this is going to be a relatively strong turnout for an August primary, or is it going to be kind of about as sleepy as usual?
Well, that's the open question, isn't it? I went into this story having that exact question in my mind. I said, well, is COVID going to keep voters away, generally speaking, compared to prior years, or is this mail-in ballot opportunity really going to boost the numbers of people participating? And I think the latter. I think if you look at the competitiveness of some of the races, I think if you look at some of the engagement of people nationally in politics, just having very strong feelings of whether it's running up to the presidential election, or whether it's the Black Lives Matter movement, or whether it's people worried about the economy. I think people are very focused on politics right now, and a lot of candidates, certainly for public office in the primary, gave me that impression. We definitely had a lot of new candidates stepping up and being willing to challenge some longstanding incumbents and go after some of the open seats. And as you say, there's very focused attention on the lieutenant governor's race and on the gubernatorial races in the state. And so I think there's a lot of voter interest. Working against that, I think, is some of the fear that they, don't want to, go to the polls and expose themselves to large groups of people. But I think once you give them that mail-in ballot option, there's a lot of evidence that that they're participating in greater numbers than in the past. Statewide, apparently, there have been 147,668 absentee ballot requests so far total, and that compares to just 107,000 people who voted in the entire primary last year. But as you say, you got to compare presidential to presidential. So that same period in 2016 was 120,000 people who voted in the primary total. This is according to the Secretary of State's office. And so there's there's more people who have requested to vote by absentee ballot this year by a long shot than the entirety of the people who voted in the primary election in 2016. So it still remains to be seen how many people are going to return those ballots, right? Some of those ballots might sit on the kitchen table, unfortunately, and not be returned. But from what Carol and from what other people around the state have been telling me is that they really do see a significant uptick in the absentee ballots. And we also heard from some clerks that they're seeing people who never registered to vote or not who never signed up to vote in a primary before or who just and you know if you talk to clerks from small enough towns they can tell who these names are, right? They know so and so hasn't voted in 10 years or 20 years or ever. And
right,
so they can kind of see when there's new folks showing up to participate, and we definitely heard from some folks that they're seeing that.
Carol Dawes, what do you think? Are more people, I mean, are people coming out of the woodwork in Barrie, as Kevin just described?
Oh, definitely, definitely. When we go into the statewide election system to data enter absentee ballot requests, we can see a voter's history of absentee ballot requests over the last 10 years or whatever, and a huge number of them have no prior request for an absentee ballot, no prior voting in the August primaries. This is the first time, and I think that to me, what it really shows is that the extra level of outreach with the postcards made a huge difference.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, do you think it's purely that, or do you think it's also a case of nobody's going out to bars and restaurants very much, so I mean, so you're kind of sitting at home looking for things to do, and, gee, I got this postcard here.
Yeah,
I
certainly I think there's some of it. I think, as Kevin was saying, you know, that there seems to be an increased interest globally with regards to politics and public discourse and issues and so I think that people are getting more involved, looking for ways to get involved. And since our opportunities for doing other things and getting distracted by other things, those opportunities have narrowed, I think it's allowing people to focus.
All righty. Let's bring in a listener who's calling in. I believe it's, is it Rich from Starksboro?
Yes.
Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning. Yes.
Okay, I didn't hear
how are you doing, Rich?
Thingy go. I have a question about other states. The President Obama, in his eulogy to John Lewis, mentioned voter suppression. So let's talk about other states, and I don't want to. But you talked about the unreturned absentee ballots. Suppose a large group of people return the ballots, and the ballots arrive, and then they get shredded and never used. Wouldn't that be a possible technique for voter suppression, since they have the person's name on the return slot on the outside of the envelope?
So your thought is let's say the local election official knows that this guy John Smith, we were just a hypothetical voter we were describing, knows that John Smith is a Republican, let's say, and expects that John Smith will be supporting certain candidates in the Republican primary, and shreds that returned envelope with the ballots in it in hopes of trying to suppress that party's vote, or what do you describe there, Rich? Is that
you got people to operate a town clerk's office. I'd like your guest to tell me how viable and easy that would be to do in some of those states that do a lot of voter suppression.
Carol Dawes, what can you tell us?
Well, I can say for myself and for every town clerk that I know, we take election, the responsibilities associated with holding fair and equitable elections as one of the highest duties that we have associated with our oath of office. I certainly can't imagine.
Just for the mechanics of the situation, is it mechanically possible to do that quite readily?
I'm sorry?
Rich wants to know if it's mechanically possible to do that kind of stuff.
Well, I mean, certainly shredding anything is mechanically possible.
Yeah.
You know, we have to account for everything in and out. You know, the only restriction that we have with regards to absentee ballots is that they must be received by 7 o'clock on election day. Right.
Yep.
If they're received after that, then they aren't counted.
Got it.
That's the only restriction.
Carol Dawes, the city clerk in Barrie, and Kevin McCollum of 7 Days. This half hour has gone by like in a blur, really fast. Thank the two of you for joining me very much. I appreciate your input here, and thanks again.
Thanks.
Going to head off to a CBS News break at the top of the hour. More of the Dave Graham Show to follow. Stay with us, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Daily takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry. Puzzles and toys for all ages. Art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back. Thanks for staying with us into our second hour on this Wednesday morning, August the 5th, 2020. And as we like to do after the top of the hour mid-show news, we bring in one of our national correspondents for a one-on-one conversation here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. And today we have with us Leonard Steinhorn of CBS News. Leonard, good morning. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, glad to be here.
So, all the chatter I'm hearing is that Joe Biden is very, very close to picking a vice presidential running mate. And first of all, what do you understand about the timing of this? When are we expecting an announcement?
Well, he better be very, very close because there's only 12 days to his convention.
Yeah.
As we know, he would have chosen somebody last month had the virus not changed the dates of the convention. So it's probably going to happen sometime next week. My sense is that they feel that they don't really need to, you know, give the president more time to attack the vice presidential candidate, and instead would prefer the president to keep creating mistakes and news that can be held against him. And I think they're going through the final vetting process to make sure their I's are dotted, their T's are crossed, that there's no surprises that can emerge from the person that they ultimately choose, to make sure that the conversations and the working relationship between Joe Biden and his VP running mate will be good and consistent, and they've created that strong bond. So I think all of that is in its final stages. The buzz, of course, is that it's down to just a few candidates. But again, we don't know that. Remember Sarah Palin. Remember Dan Quayle. Remember Dick Cheney. You know, all surprises that nobody really expected at that point. So anything is possible, even if the chatter says, well, it's probably Kamala Harris or Susan Rice or maybe Karen Bass, but she stumbled on the Sunday shows when asked certain questions. Maybe Tammy Duckworth, maybe Elizabeth Warren. Those are the names that you are hearing the most now. But again, what the chatter says doesn't mean that that's going to be the choice.
Is Val Deming still in the running, or is she off the list now?
I believe she's potentially still in the running, at least from the chatter. But her star hasn't risen quite as high in recent days. So, but again, you can't count anyone out. And you know what? Some of it could be head fakes. Some of it could be trial balloons. Some of it could be throwing names out just to see what the reaction is. So you never know with the strategy that political campaigns use to float certain things to get certain things out, to test them out, to see what people are saying, and all the rest. So every single public statement, every single confirmation of a rumor, that's all strategically thought through as well.
One reason I kind of like Val Demings, and it's not really a matter of I don't have that much familiarity really with her, but in terms of the resume and just kind of on paper, here we have a woman of color, and obviously several of the candidates, leading candidates for the pick, are women of color. Joe Biden has said he wants to pick a woman. there's a lot of discussion that a woman of color would really help to basically, you know, be a mark of more progress toward racial equality in the United States, and it would also be a way to bring, you know, really solidify support in the African American community, for instance. But Val Demings has another part of her resume, which is I think really could be really intriguing at this time, and that's just her prior career as a well respected police chief. Because with so much consternation around police conduct and so on, this summer really peaking, you know, since the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis and maybe some of the overbearing police reactions to demonstrations around the country and so on, to kind of reach across that bridge might be a really interesting piece of strategy as well. I don't know, what do you think, Leonard?
Well, when her name first came up, I was thinking along those lines as well. I mean, she can basically say, hey, this is what I did. You can't, you know, say that I'm soft on crime. I know what's wrong, and I know how to help fix it. And that would be the messaging that I would use if I were advising her on something like this. She Yep. also has a very compelling personal life story, sort of overcoming adversity in life and mm-hmm. and really sort of finding a way through her law enforcement background to really, you know, sort of create a life, create a career, create a public presence. And obviously she was highly praised and well respected in the Orlando community for the work that she did, and that's one of the reasons why she was able to run for Congress and win. Yep. So, yeah, I think she's probably in the list. You haven't heard her name quite as much in recent days. But again, I'm not so sure what that means. You know, let's be clear. The media, we all love to throw out names because we all need good copy. You know?
Yep, sure,
and
sure.
So
yep.
you can probably fill, you know, an entire encyclopedia with articles in years past speculating on who would become vice president or who is best to be vice president. And all of those articles turned out to be inaccurate or wrong. So look, part of it is just sort of the culture we're in because we don't have as much news about what's going on. This is a big consequential decision. This is somebody who should be ready to step into the Oval Office if need be. And it also has political consequences. Is it going to charge up the base? Is it going to make people more confident in Joe Biden? Is it going to be, you know, get people out to vote? I was part of a survey we conducted with African-American voters just recently. And what we found, for example, is that there's not a lot of enthusiasm among 18 to 29-year-old African-Americans for Joe Biden. But, you know, that enthusiasm rises considerably if he chooses an African-American vice president. So, yes, this can have significant political consequences to motivate people to vote for him. The other thing they just have to figure out, you know, Joe Biden is that interpersonal type of guy, you know? He loves to have a bond with somebody. Can this person be a partner with Joe Biden as he becomes president or if he becomes president? And I think to him, that's really important. And my guess is right now, in his own mind, that's what he's trying to figure out.
That chemistry, yeah. Biden is kind of Mr. Chemistry in many respects. So I get what you're saying on that front. Hey, I just want to speculate a little bit and roll a clock forward to the debates. I guess three debates would be scheduled between the presidential nominees. And one between the vice presidential nominees. I'm wondering what should people be expecting in a trio of Trump-Biden debates?
Well, one thing they probably won't have, given social mm-hmm. distancing, is what Donald Trump did to Hillary Clinton in 2016 when he was basically walking and hovering behind her. I don't think that will happen.
Yeah.
So the stagecraft is actually going to be somewhat different. I guess they'll be able to stand at their sort of podium and be able to, you know, stay there. I don't think there'll be as much movement. I don't know if they'll have the type of debate where people will be sitting in the audience, because I don't think that will work. But in terms of the back and forth, I mean, look, we can pretty much know what Donald Trump will do, because we've seen that, and he's been fairly consistent all along. He was consistent in terms of how he debated in 2016. He's been consistent in terms of how he talks with the press and does public appearances throughout his presidency. I think the real wild card here is Joe Biden. We have seen many different versions of Joe Biden during debates. You know, the last debate he had against Bernie Sanders, he was energetic. He was on it. He was, you know, quick to respond, quick to make his point. He seemed sharp. He seemed good. But then we saw him in other debates where there were multiple candidates on the stage where he seemed out of his element. He didn't sort of want to articulate certain ideas. He sort of said, well, the clock has stopped, I'll be quiet. He just didn't come off as very impressive. So I think the bigger question will be, which Joe Biden shows up to these debates. And if the Joe Biden of that last Bernie Sanders debate shows up, I think that will go a long way toward answering a lot of the questions that the Trump campaign has been raising about Joe Biden. Well, that he's old, or that his mental facilities aren't as good anymore, and all the rest. If he does that, he will answer those questions. And I think that's a big, big deal.
Yeah, I guess that is a real question in terms of just which Joe Biden will show up. And I wonder, maybe he is just more comfortable in a one-on-one format than he is, you know, trying to get his hand up in the air when he's one of a dozen or something. That's another possibility, I mean, just in terms of the style of presentation or whatever.
Yeah, I think so, you saw that when he went toe-to-toe in 2008 and 2012 against Sarah Palin and Paul Ryan, the Republican mm-hmm. nominees in those years, he was strong. He pushed back. He knew the facts. He knew the information. I think another question will be, look, let's be honest here. All the evidence of these 4 years of the Trump presidency and before that, the president will be loose with the facts. The president will say things that may not be wholly accurate or truthful. So then the question becomes, what do the moderators do when faced with that? What does Joe Biden do when faced with that? It's not to say that Joe Biden won't come off as some of his own whoppers. But, you know, when you look at the Washington Post compilation of thousands upon thousands of falsehoods or even lies that the president has told, will he be willing to do that in a debate? And if so, how does the press deal with it? How do the moderators deal with it? And how does Biden deal with it?
All important questions. Well, we'll have to wait and see how that all unfolds, but it's good to get a little bit of a preview now. Leonard Steinhorn of CBS News, I thank you very much for joining me this morning. It's great chatting with you.
Always happy to be here. Thanks.
All righty. Hey, before we go to the break, we do have a listener on the line. Fred's calling in from Newbury. Good morning, Fred.
Morning. Hey, you know, the Founding Fathers really were geniuses because they figured out a way during the presidential election to find out if the country is polarized.
How's that?
Well, if the president just wins the electoral college and loses the popular vote, that's obvious that the country's polarized.
Yeah, that usually that would happen typically in a very, very close election. So and in a close election, I guess that's you mean pretty much even the country's evenly split there. That's another way to describe polarized or what?
Well, I mean, the majority of people didn't want him, whether it's 1% or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, 51%, that's the majority of the people. Right?
Yep. Well, so there you go. That's the way. Do you like the electoral college system, Fred? I'm sorry?
I do like the electoral college system.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Do you like it?
I I think we're getting to an age now where we probably could go to a popular vote system. Electoral college system probably made sense when it was much more difficult to get communications around the country. So you couldn't really just, you know, nobody was calling Illinois and then Nevada and then Washington State on election night back in those days. So you kind of had to have, you know, people from the various states gather to say, of course, they weren't. Nevada and Washington State weren't states back in those days, but nor was Illinois, I guess, back at the founding. But you know what I mean. Just the idea of gathering all this information from a very widely scattered geographic region. Communications, people don't remember, but communications were not what they are today. The Battle of New Orleans was fought in 1814 after the Treaty of Ghent was signed, ending the war.
That's right. But the kicker is, do we have to have a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Electoral College?
Say again?
Do we have to have a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Electoral College?
Well, there's this outfit, I think it's called National Popular Vote. You can Google that. And they have a strategy which basically states can pass a law saying that in our state, we're going to support the winner of the national popular vote, and our electors will do that. And if enough states do that, then you sort of de facto will change the system in much the same way that a constitutional amendment on this would change the system. But I'm a little vague on the details there, so somebody could correct me. But I think that's how their proposal works. And
that would end up going to the Supreme Court, I bet.
Yeah, well, you know, that we can. That's kind of speculation at this point. But, hey, Fred, I got to jump, but thanks for the call. I've been trying to set up a regular Wednesday thing with our State Department of Fish and Wildlife. There's so much interest around Vermont in issues relating to fish and wildlife hunting and wildlife preservation and all that stuff that we're trying to get a kind of a regular thing going with our friends at Fish and Wildlife. And Lewis Porter, the commissioner there, has been very helpful in setting us up with various topics to talk about on this second hour of Wednesday's programs. And so I'm hoping we can do sort of a regular thing on fish and wildlife for a while anyway going forward. Got a note from Lewis yesterday. He was saying that the Fish and Wildlife Department has been working on a new 10-year plan for big game in Vermont. And big game in the Vermont wildlife world includes bear, moose, deer, and turkey. And they're talking about how to manage these four species into the next or through the next decade. There's actually a public hearing going to be happening virtually, meaning online, this evening to pick up some public input, they hope, about how these things should go. And I wanted to bring in a couple of people in from the Department of Fish and Wildlife this morning to talk about what the issues are with these four species and what they're hoping to generate in terms of public participation this evening. Joining me on the phone are Mark Scott, who is the director of the Wildlife Division at the Department of Fish and Wildlife. So that's a pretty big portfolio he's got there. And Adam Miller is the head of the game species biologists. So they obviously play a big role in trying to figure out how are those populations doing out there and how are we doing in terms of managing their numbers, etc. So, gentlemen, I thank you both for joining me this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And let me start with you, Mark Scott, if I could. First off, do I have it right? There's a public hearing tonight, and if so, what do people do if they want to participate?
You got it right, Dave. I just emphasize it's a public meeting. We're going to share some information where we don't have to set any rules or regulations, which is a little bit different when we do our formal public hearings to do that. But this plan really stage for those future formal public hearings where we're going to do a rule setting or we get certain feedback that we maybe have to visit legislature to make sure that we try to do improvements to sustain Vermont's big game species. But, hey, thanks a lot for recognizing the wildlife interest in the state. It's something that's real. I tell folks I think half our job is more dealing with people, and it should be. It's really wildlife today and in the hands of your listeners that are on board this morning.
Yeah, if you got into this line of work hoping you'd only have to deal with deer and moose and bears and turkeys, you were missing a key species in all these conversations, which is Homo sapiens, right?
you got it. You know, we got roughly 50 wild mammals running around the state, and hopefully new exotic. Yeah, but we also got the one you identified, the human. And that's a real challenge because humans are part of this earth. They have a huge footprint on the earth, and they impact it. And everybody has a different interest in how they interact with wildlife, whether it's with a gun in the hunting season, binoculars in the spring, or just seeing it in your backyard.
Yeah. Hey, so just to be clear, these hearings, and by the way, this is the last in a series of hearings tonight. Do I understand that right? Or listening sessions? I'm not sure exactly how you wanted to, what's the proper terminology here. It sounds like it's more of a listening session than a formal hearing, though.
I have to apologize. I've been with the state almost for a decade, so I get caught up in the bureaucratic language. But it is important to us how we define these and the process that we use. But, you know, the department, we average about 15 to 20 public meetings, public hearings during the year, all the time working with people. This one here is a big game plan. I think you noted it the other day when I was listening on the radio. Just kind of putting the final dot on that plan before the commissioner does the final signature. And we also get the final check-in with our regulatory Fish and Wildlife Board, which is 14 people. We work with them hand-in-hand on most of the species. But I'd like to have Adam kick in and give a few details on tonight's meeting so the people out there who want to participate, we welcome it. I've got to tell you, the thing I enjoy the most is being a native Vermonter myself is the passion that people have for wildlife, all different sorts. And I think that's what keeps driving a lot of us to try to sort through all that different passion and do the best we can for the critters out there, but also for people's interests. But Adam, could you give the details?
Absolutely. And Mark hit the nail right on the head. This is a document that we put together, a plan that we put together once every 10 years. We've had multiple iterations of this. For this process, it started about a year and a half or 2 years ago with kind of drafting out the different key issues and strategies that we're going to deal with it. But tonight is, the point in time where we're reaching out to the full public. We've reached out to different stakeholder groups already that have a interest in fish and wildlife. But now this is, you know, out for everyone to comment on and provide input. It's tonight from 6:30 to 8:00. We're doing it as a virtual meeting. It's on our Microsoft Teams channel. And folks can go to www.vtfishandwildlife.com and just type in the search bar "big game plan" and you'll get taken to a page that has the link to the meeting. And for folks that can't participate via computer, there's a call-in number that folks can call into and join electronically. And we encourage folks that, you know, whether you're able to participate in the meeting tonight or not, to go onto our website and take a look at our big game plan. It's a little bit of a read. It's about 50 pages, but we're accepting, you know, any public comment, written comments accepted until next Wednesday. And for folks to submit comments, they can email anr.fwpublic@vermont.gov. And we take all those public comments seriously when we're factoring in the public input and trying to finalize this plan.
Yep. Okay, ANR, give me that email again. It's ANR.
Sure, it's anr.fwpublic@vermont.gov.
Okay, just for people who want to follow the logic there, ANR stands for Agency of Natural Resources. Don't forget the dot after ANR. FW, I'm sure, stands for Fish and Wildlife. And public comment would be just sort of a continuation of the word that starts here with FW, all spelled out, right? No dots or anything?
That's correct. Correct.
And all right. But that just so people can get the exact sequence of figures and letters down, because emails sometimes could be a little confusing that way. So anyway... Well, this is fascinating to me, and I would gather that as you work on this 10-year plan for the in fact, I was flipping through it last evening, and clearly there are some different issues with the different species. One of them in connection with bears and deer in particular, that I hear a lot about it. I lived in Montpelier in a pretty, you know, thickly settled, you know, just a half mile from the corner of State and Main Street, so kind of downtown. And there are bears coming down out of the woods at the edge of town occasionally, and a lot of deer. The deer, let's see, I think they went after our green peppers, and then they got our hostas. They must have had the green peppers first and said hasta mañana or something. But what about this? Are some of these species making more frequent appearances in urban areas, I guess is my question.
Well, Dave, Mark Scott here.
You
hit it right on. Bear and bear can make or break a commissioner of our department. And I say that she can say it in all seriousness. That, you know, we've still got 70,000 people who love to hunt in the state of Vermont, as well as a lot of non-residents. It's a huge opportunity with all of us.
Hey, let me let you continue with this answer on the other side of a break. We got to go to the bottom of the hour news here, and we'll be right back and continue our conversation with Mark Scott and Adam Miller of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Stay with us, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Daily takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
My guests are Adam Miller and Mark Scott of the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife. We are talking about a 10-year plan that is in the creative process right now, and there's the subject of a public meeting tonight where the Fish and Wildlife Department wants to hear from Vermonters all around the state about what they think about the future of our big game species, and those include in Vermont, those include deer, moose, bears, and turkeys. I did not know turkey was a big game species until, I know that some of them look pretty big as you're driving by and see a flock of them in a farm field or something, but I did not know they qualified as a big game species. But we were talking just before the break, Mark Scott, you were commenting on basically a question I had about it seems like, just anecdotally, that there's an increasing number of encounters between folks living in even fairly urban areas. You know, I was saying I live in near downtown Montpelier, and we get visits from deer who tend to get after our vegetable garden, much to particularly my wife's annoyance. You know, I sort of take things a little easier on this front than maybe she does, but is this a thing? Are we seeing more deer coming into town lately?
You're right on. You're seeing more deer, and it's a serious concern of ours. Montpelier, Rutland, Burlington area, a few of these high populated cities, Newport, and it's we don't want deer to become a nuisance animal, and they're a valuable animal to have out on the landscape. So you're absolutely right. The same with bear. So these are the key points that we try to focus on in our management efforts.
And so if I'm a member of the public and I'm in this meeting tonight and I'm saying, I'm tired of these deer coming down and eating my green peppers and my hostas and all the rest, what are you going to tell me?
I'm saying thank you for saying that, because what we need to have to move forward is the support to the powers to be in these towns, i.e. Montpelier, Burlington, and so forth, to make sure they have rules and regulations in place that encourage safe hunting practices. We're willing to work with all these towns. We're willing to do everything we can. But if the town people and landowners don't allow hunters access to the land, there's very little we can do to deal with the issue.
My yard wouldn't allow anybody to fire a weapon at an animal. I thought there was you're supposed to be a certain distance from a house typically, right?
No, And we're actually pushing archery, which is a very safe activity. Even hunting is safe because people who pull the trigger are responsible with the pull gun. But, you know, Montpelier allows hunting, but you have a huge area called Hubbard Park where those deer go and cover, and there's no hunting there. You have some people in their backyards that got larger areas that would allow hunting. The problem is going to be is archery hunting is done such that you hit a deer with a sharp blade, razor blade at the end of the arrow, and the deer bleeds out. So most likely, if somebody was hunting in someone's backyard in Montpelier, that deer may run over and die in someone else's backyard. And we're living with a society today that just doesn't want to see something die. That's the reality.
So basically what you're saying is if people have to get used to the idea that we are going to have to kill some of these animals in order to thin out the population that's coming down and causing these problems for people.
Well, we are. And you know, we had a special game dinner actually right in Montpelier last year in the city. And that's all I heard. I heard from similar stories to what you're saying, Dave. Tremendous strong support from people. And, you know, venison and bear meat is a highly nutritious, valuable food to have. And we're seeing a strong uptick in the interest of people. You know, we kind of call it the local war movement, you know, and the back to fire movement, roots in Vermont. All of this interest of people to get healthy food. It's a resource out there to use. You know, again, we're quite sensitive to the cultural changes that are happening in Vermont. There's no doubt about it.
Adam Miller, as a biologist, I'm wondering, are there any particular, I don't know, kind of trends in the, let's take the deer population for starters, because I think they're even more prevalent in some of our urban areas than bears are, although we'll talk about bears in a minute. But anything going on with deer biology or habitat, that et cetera, that might be causing more of them to, or a higher percentage of the deer that exist to come down into settled areas, or is it more a matter of just there are more deer, bigger population, and therefore they're spreading out looking for food?
Well, Dave, you know, not just with deer, but with a number of big game species, you know, bear included, there's a large scale kind of change in the habitat that's out there. You know, deer are a species which really, you know, prefer and need, you know, early primary growth. So kind of young shoots of trees and you know, brambles and things like that to survive. And one of the things that's really important is kind of maintaining active habitat management. So not just, you know, letting everything grow up to be one large age structure, but kind of having a diverse habitat. And, you know, bears just are a fine example, just like deer, of, you know, they're going to go wherever the easiest meal is. And if they have to travel over a long period of, or a long range of habitat to get to food versus going into someone's backyard and, you know, eating, you know, for deer, it's, you know, eating your hostas and pepper plants versus, you know, a bear. Maybe the closest food is, you know, someone's garbage that's not being taken care of in an appropriate manner. They're going to go wherever it's the easiest meal. So I think one of the main focuses of our plan and the change probably from this 10-year plan compared to last 10 years plan is a real focus on habitat, as well as a focus on kind of human wildlife conflict and, you know, addressing ways to do that, whether that be through hunting or, you know, in the case of what we're doing with bears, it's trying to educate people on the, you know, the values of living amongst bears and how to better live with them. You know, we view it as a real positive thing that, you know, if our big game plan, this document, is helping to promote public understanding that promotes appreciation for wildlife, whether that be bear, deer, moose, or turkey, that, you know, it's going to mean that there's more support for living with these creatures, you know, on an everyday basis and promoting healthy populations.
Yeah, well, let's talk about bears for a moment, because there have been a lot of, you know, stories online and in the media and so on this summer about people seeing more bears in their backyards, et cetera. I have one friend who has posted repeated game camera videos on Facebook where this bear keeps trying to get into his shed and he's very proud of the fact that the bear has so far been unsuccessful in getting into his shed. So it's quite a humorous little kind of almost a comedy routine or something. But why is it that this seems to be more of a feature of Vermont life these days than it was 30 years ago? I'll ask you, Mark.
Well, you hear me okay, Dave? It's our cell phone business here that we deal with in Vermont.
Yeah, I can. It's not beautiful, but it's workable, I think, for right now.
Apologize to your listeners to do that. But, you know, we've got Vermont's landscape has changed. And that, you know, we used to be that the bear numbers are way higher today, double of what they were back in the 70s and 80s. The whole field of wildlife management, back when I started in the department in the 1980s, we were usually on a trend to try to see more animals, you know, more bear. The public wanted to see more. We were managing that way. We've always had a trouble with too many deer for the landscape out there, but not so much in people's backyards the way it's occurred today, and as well mm-hmm. as turkeys. And, you know, turkeys, you see them all the time, and what we're trying to do is making sure they don't become a nuisance to people. We want them to be a valuable part of our landscape out there, not only for hunters, but for predators like bobcat. They like to feed on turkeys and fox and coyote. And also people like to see wildlife to do it. So the landscape has changed. Also deal with climate change. That's a huge issue. We're addressing it now in the plan that probably deer survival is a lot higher now in Vermont in certain places, certain regions, because of milder winters.
You said deer survival is much higher now?
Yeah. In certain areas, okay. We still have trouble where we get the tough winters in the Northeast Kingdom or the mountainous areas. We try to work to protect deer wintering areas. We work with Act 250 primarily as our key tool to protect those areas from development. We work with foresters. But, you know, when we have warmer winters, deer's an animal of the South, really. You get 18 inches of snow and cold weather. That limits their ability to survive. So it's just a matter of how many days you have during the year of that type of weather.
And you said the bear population is about double what it was back in say 1980. I'm wondering is that due also to climate change, or is that due to fewer people hunting them, or
It's due to our regulations. Humans are the main controlling factor through hunting on bear numbers. So we restricted people harvesting bear during the deer seasons for a period of time. That's when more bear were harvested. We basically went on a protectionist mode, still having hunting seasons available to keep bears wild. Our biggest issue now is we're basically managing bear at a social carrying capacity. We could have more bears probably in Vermont. The problem is, as Adam alluded to with the habitat, they're going down and finding easy meals in people's backyards. And once they learn that, once they learn they can get a free meal on some sunflower seeds, the mother will teach cubs to do that, and it doesn't change.
Yeah, and so that's why we hear all the time that people really should bring in their bird feeders in starting in the early spring, when bears are about to come out of hibernation, right? And then essentially let the birds fend for themselves during the warmer months when there's stuff for them to eat, and maybe go back to a bird feeder in the winter, right?
Dave, we commonly refer to it a lot as it's not necessarily a bear problem, it's a human problem, and we're, the main purpose of kind of what we're doing right now with our outreach and education efforts, especially with bear conflict, is trying to educate people of those kind of training tactics that they maintain that create a problem bear. So, making sure that you put away your garbage properly, making sure that you're composting properly, making sure that you're taking your bird feeder down at certain times of the year. You know, that's really important, because once that bear has learned and connected humans and that bad behavior of learning where that easy meal is, it's really hard to train them away from that. And, the outcome doesn't turn out the best for humans or for the wildlife that are, fall victim to those practices.
Let's bring in a listener who's calling in. I believe it's Tom from Richmond. Good morning, Tom.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to ask the question of, if you take a youth hunting, which I do, and they shoot a buck during youth season, does that mean they no longer can hunt again come rifle season?
No.
Who wants to take it? Mark?
No, they can still hunt. They can. The exception in the law is for people hunting the novice or youth weekend that they can take an additional buck.
So they can take two bucks.
The adults cannot take two bucks. Youth who harvested deer during the youth weekend may shoot another buck. That's the one exception in the new law that we have.
Okay, I thank you very much for that.
All right. Thanks for the call. That's one of those practical questions that we like to get answered when we have the experts on board here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. And we're talking about a 10-year plan for Vermont's big game wildlife. These species include, they do include turkeys, as well as a bear, deer, and moose. And we are talking with Mark Scott and Adam Miller of the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife. A virtual public meeting is scheduled for this evening, Wednesday, August 5th, 2020, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. The meeting will be held via Microsoft Teams on a computer or a smartphone, accessible there. Please download the Microsoft Teams application ahead of time. Participants can also call into the meeting on telephone by at 802-828-7667 and entering another code number, which is 7435-79474. That's 7435-79474. And that's to get access to this evening's virtual meeting hosted by the Department of Fish and Wildlife. They are drafting a 10-year plan for management of big game species in Vermont, of which there are four. They are deer, turkeys, bears, and moose. And we have talking with us this morning about the work underway to draft this plan and what some of the issues are that are being grappled with. We have Adam Miller, who's a biologist at the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and also the Wildlife Division Director. Mark Scott is with us as well. And Mark, in the process of hearing from folks so far in the development of this plan, what would you say is the number one issue you're hearing from residents of Vermont? Okay. Mark Scott apparently has gone on a... Okay, Mark Scott, I don't know if you heard my last question, but I was just asking, as you have worked to draft this plan, this 10-year plan for management of big game in Vermont, what is the number one question you're hearing from Vermonters, a question or concern?
Oh, that's a great one. I'd say from hunters, it seems to be access to land, posted property, wanting to have more opportunity. From people who do not hunt, and we've made an effort to reach out to both groups, it's having good land conservation, maintaining ecological integrity of our forests, making sure our forests are healthy, giving high abundance of deer, concerned about deer damaging trees and regeneration of valuable timber. And I think Adam hit it earlier, bear. The public just wants us maybe to spend a lot more time educating bear. I think what's really the positive is the passion that Vermonters, whether they hunt or not, still have for our big game species.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a lot of interest, and I know it's a thrill that the handful of times I've just driving around Vermont and I spot a moose or something, wow, there's a moose, it is. You get a charge out of that, and I think a lot of people do, and a lot of people enjoy that, and certainly visitors to our state from maybe more populated areas where they don't get a chance to see wildlife very much, when they spot something like a moose or a bear, it's a lifetime memory for them. So that is something that's very, very important to an awful lot of people.
Right on. It is for me, too, and I know all of our staff the same way. That's why we're in this business. And I think a lot of people live in Vermont for that reason alone.
Yeah. I'm wondering, how do you sort of, knit together all these public questions and concerns out there, I'll put this question to Adam Miller, I think, first, and maybe ask Mark to give you your answer afterward. But Adam, clearly there are different camps here out there in the Vermont public. There are some folks who are quite opposed to hunting in general. They think it's cruel and inhumane and all the rest. And maybe the vegetarians, they don't really see the need for harvesting meat, and they don't like the whole process. And then there are other people who are staunch defenders of hunting as a real key tradition, and so on. How do you balance and weigh those competing interests out there?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Dave. And you know, one of the ways that we try and balance a lot of these kinds of things out is we apply the science. And one of the ways that we can apply good, sound social science is through the use of statistically valid scientific surveys, public surveys. And in particular for Vermont's big game plan and our iteration of the big game plan, we maintain a regular, public survey on people's thoughts and perceptions and opinions and preferences on big game. And that's something that we consulted with as we're going through this drafting process, and we continually reach out to folks throughout this process, and we'll follow up afterwards with surveys. And I'm sure Mark can add a little bit more, as he's kind of overseen some of those processes over the years through multiple iterations of the big game plan.
Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, Dave, we probably have more public meetings and hearings than any other state agency in the government. I know Lewis Porter, when he came on as commissioner from the governor's office. And so we are constantly out there trying to get the pulse of the public. A lot of us engage. We have 35 to 40 field wardens. They're interacting with people all the time. They're our key ambassadors. So we're constantly getting input into how we're doing, checks and balances, to do that. But the bottom line is, for everybody to enjoy and have these animals on the landscape long term, we have to follow the science. We've got to work with the land. We have to have habitat. We have to have a good land management. We need foresters in the state of Vermont that we get to work with. And we got to know biology about the species. You got to be able to collect data to do that. One of the big issues we're worried about right now in Vermont, especially with COVID, has made it worse. This shutdown is the forest economy. We need people out there in certain places cutting trees. That's the bottom line. That creates a habitat, so deer will go to these cut areas instead of your backyard on teacher houses.
Yeah, I'm all in favor of deer staying out in the woods. Actually, I do love deer, but boy, when I get my green peppers or my hostas, I get annoyed. Anyway, that's just. Well, we are about out of time. I really appreciate Mark Scott and Adam Miller, two folks from the Fish and Wildlife Department. Don't forget, folks, this evening, virtual hearing. You can get on to Microsoft Teams and go to the Fish and Wildlife meeting tonight. They're taking public input on their 10-year plan for big game in Vermont: moose, bears, deer, and turkeys. And so it's important stuff, and participation welcome. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We are going to wrap it up for today's edition of the Dave Graham Show. Tune in again tomorrow for another edition of our show. Meanwhile, stay tuned today for Common Sense Radio. Bill Sayre will be talking with you all tomorrow, folks. Have a good afternoon.